Amos Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. More than 6 years after the start of the Iraq War, U.S. troops officially handed over urban combat duties to the Iraqi police and soldiers today. This is part of an agreement to withdraw the 130,000 American troops from that country by the end of December 2011. Iraqis celebrated last night, even while there are concerns about instability in the region and an increase in violent attacks in their country. 250 Iraqis have been killed by bombings in the last 10 days. 4 U.S. soldiers were killed yesterday. My guest, retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich, has been a critic of U.S. policy in Iraq. He served in the Vietnam War and is currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His most recent book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, is now out in paperback. He joins us today to talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, and the challenges and responsibilities facing the world's lone superpower. And Andrew Basevich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks very much for have them in your program.
You're very welcome. You wrote something 4 years ago in the Washington Post, August 2005. The United States needs to liquidate its presence in Iraq, placing the onus on Iraqis to decide their fate and creating the space for another regional powers to assist in brokering a political settlement. We've done all that we can do. With that in mind, what's your reaction to today's handover?
Well, the story is not over yet. As you said, we still got 130,000 troops there. My friend Tom Ricks published a book, his second book on Iraq, called The Gamble, about 6 months ago. And Ricks's conclusion in the book says that the events for which we will remember Iraq have not happened yet. And I suspect that's likely to be the case. This is a long way from being over. Now, as somebody who thought the war was unnecessary from the outset, I'm certainly happy about any steps that we are making toward leaving. I would persist in the comment in that piece that I wrote several years ago that at the end of the day, Iraqis will determine the fate of Iraq, and we can't do that.
Do you, though, have faith in the political culture and the politicians in Iraq to deal with some of the divisions within their country? Because so much of the focus has been on the military and security forces
right.
in Iraq.
I wouldn't want to set myself up as some kind of an expert in Iraqi culture and politics and so on. I'm sort of a consumer of the news. It does seem to me that the legitimacy of the new Iraqi government, its ability to command the assent and loyalty of citizens, is limited and likely to be very questionable. It also seems to me that, you've noted violence does continue. It's not like this is a land where peace has arrived. At the end of the day, so much of the future of Iraq is going to turn on the Iraqi security forces. Turn on questions of their competence and also turn on questions of their loyalty. Are they loyal to Iraq or are they loyal to a party? Or are they loyal to a leader? And I think it's very difficult for us to make judgments on those questions at this point.
This is a kind of philosophical, even moral question, but what do you think the United States owes Iraq since they did not invite us into their country? We went into that country for our own particular reasons.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very difficult question to answer. I have come to believe that there's a, you know, if you are a policymaker, if you're President Obama, and you sit down and contemplate that over your scotch some evening, that there really is a prior question that deserves consideration. And the prior question is, What's the moral obligation of the United States government to the American people, and what's the moral obligation that we have to those who serve in uniform? And I believe very strongly that the core obligation that we owe our soldiers is to not abuse them, to not send them into unnecessary wars. This was an unnecessary war, I'm not trying to punt on you to say that the moral obligation to the Iraqis can be dismissed out of hand, but I do think that there are other claims that come first.
What do you think the lessons are of the Iraq War, and do you think we have even begun to think about or even learn those lessons?
I think there's a – I mean, it is striking to me that there is so little interest in actually pursuing that question in a sustained way. I mean, you can't help. Iraq is back in the news today because of this handover. But the truth of the matter is Iraq had all but disappeared from the American consciousness over the previous 12 months. We have, as a nation, moved on, as it were. I think that that is deeply unfortunate. There really needs to be, I think, a sustained effort, nonpartisan effort, to try to understand how this war came about and why mistakes occurred as they did and what we can take overall from the experience. Now, my own view, and again, I would want to insist that, I'm not trying to argue that I got all the answers here, but it seems to me that the, from my point of view, the great lesson is that we have, as a people, and our political leadership in particular, we have vastly overstated the efficacy of armed force. It's difficult now to recall, I think, the expectations that existed when Operation Iraqi Freedom was launched back in March of 2003, but the expectations were that American military dominance would almost necessarily achieve rapid decision at minimal cost. And that turned out to be anything but the case. So we need to rethink the efficacy of force, and therefore we need to sort of rethink our approach to statecraft and to consider the possibility that that approach has been excessively militarized, or to put it another way, has not adequately emphasized other instruments of power.
Do you think, though, the fact that we have a volunteer military in this country and the fact that such a tiny percent of the population has family or has served in the military, that that has skewed how we not only look at Iraq, but also how we look at other military operations?
Absolutely. And I would say that this is another, would be another, I think, line of inquiry in an effort to discern the lessons. I mean, if you go back to the 1990s and would be able to recall the way Americans viewed their military, there was, I think, a respect, almost approaching adulation, and a minimum of understanding and a minimum of actual contact. But the so-called all-volunteer force, and I say so-called because really it's a professional army, the so-called all-volunteer force probably was viewed as the most successful federal initiative of the last quarter of the 20th century, the one thing that the federal government did that really and truly worked.
Because it was professional.
Because it was, these young people who serve are remarkably competent. They're remarkably good at what they do. And basically, I think most Americans said, since they're so good at what they do, I don't have to pay any attention to what they do. I don't have to, you know, they're just fine. And I think from our current vantage point in 2009, it's incumbent upon us to ask the question whether this arrangement actually serves the interests of the United States. It's not that we have good soldiers, but having a professional army that exists at such a distance from American society, does that lead to, is it contribute to wise policies? And I think that based on the evidence of the last roughly decade now, the answer is no, and that there's a great need to somehow restore a relationship between the army and the people, so that we don't have this circumstance where 0.5% of the population is engaged in what has actually now become, for all practical purposes, a permanent war, while the other 99.5% of the population tunes the war out and goes to the mall.
You served in Vietnam, and of course there was a draft, and it seemed that military, even political policy was to change that because of the public reaction against that particular war, thinking that if you could professionalize the military, then you wouldn't have people in the military who were since fighting against it.
Well, you know, the story of the founding of the all-volunteer force is a great story, although I think it was political calculation by one of the most cynical politicians of all time, Richard Nixon, that was really driving this. And I think Nixon decided to end the draft and to go to an all-volunteer force, not because at that particular moment he imagined that an all-volunteer force would be more effective. What he wanted to do was try to cut off the anti-war movement at the knees. And in some respects, it worked. It was very successful. And, you know, the kids, young people, didn't want a draft. They wanted to have military service become a completely optional, have it be divorced from the concept of citizenship. The principal opponents of ending the draft in those days were the senior military leaders, the JCS. The JCS said, wait a second, if we do away with the draft, we have no confidence in our ability actually to recruit all-volunteer force. Now, fast forward to 2009, and the military has long since embraced the idea of long service, highly trained, and well-disciplined forces. Today, the military doesn't want to touch the draft. So we have a political consensus. The political consensus is conscription is a bad thing. We never want to do that again. That political consensus then makes it that much more difficult to come to grips with any defects in our current military system. And I think, again, that core defect is the absence of a connection between the Army and society.
And we're about a minute away from our first break here. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that you're not calling for a return of the draft, but you're calling for people to pay attention, I guess civilians to pay attention to our military.
Yeah, what I'm going to say, it doesn't translate into a policy very well, but what we need to do is to restore the idea of military service as a component of citizenship, and so that a greater number of citizens from all walks of life will choose to serve, to include from our elites.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Andrew Basevich. He's a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. He's a retired Army colonel. He did serve in Vietnam, and his most recent book is now out in paperback. It's called The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, and we'll be talking more about Iraq, and I do want to talk about Afghanistan, another important foreign policy challenge facing the United States, and to talk in more detail about some of the ideas in his book as well. Again, it's called The Limits of Power. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Father Martin's Ashley, providing confidential alcoholism and drug addiction treatment at their 147-acre campus on the Chesapeake Bay. Father Martin's Ashley offers professional medical treatment and counseling, spiritual support and respect, all in a private bayside setting where community members can focus on recovery. Information or admissions help are available at fathermartinsashley.org/NPR or 800-799-HOPE.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Bob Pearson is passionate about local food. His passion began in the 1960s in Italy.
They would argue about what hillside the best tomatoes grew on and what hillsides produced the best grapes, and this was astounding to me. And they knew the names of the farmers, and I didn't know where any of my food in the United States came from.
The coming-of-age story this afternoon at 12:30 on WHYY. Keep the umbrella handy. A chance of shower starting this afternoon.
Thank you. On the 4th of July, be a part of America's biggest birthday party. It's a Capitol 4th from NPR. Direct from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol, you'll hear Barry Manilow, Aretha Franklin, Natasha Bedingfield, and more. I'm Lisa Simeone with your host, Jimmy Smits. Please join us for a Capitol 4th 2009 from NPR.
Saturday night at 8 o'clock on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Andrew Basevich is our guest, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, a retired Army colonel, served in Vietnam. We are talking about American foreign policy and the limits of power. That happens to be the title of his most recent book, which is now out in paperback. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You wrote in the July-August edition of the Atlantic, that creating a cohesive nation state in Afghanistan, centralized in Kabul, is a, quote, fool's errand. What should the policy in Afghanistan be?
Well, you know, the reigning assumption today is that Afghanistan represents a vital interest to the United States of America. And I think the first thing to do is to just try to step back a little bit and just consider that proposition. I mean, this is a landlocked, undeveloped country on the far side of the earth. It produces nothing that is essential to the American way of life, unless we view drugs as essential to the American way of life. And I would argue that the reality is we have actually quite limited interest there. I got another article coming out in which I argue that the truth of the matter is Mexico is a heck of a lot more important to the United States than is Afghanistan. And yet today, if somebody proposed sending 60,000 troops to Mexico in order to eliminate Mexican drug trafficking and eliminate corruption in Mexican politics and reforming the Mexican school system, they would be laughed out of Washington.
Hmm.
But people say these things about Afghanistan, and they sort of get accepted as, oh, yeah, sure. So I think the first thing is we need to look critically at this issue of how important Afghanistan is.
Let me just stop you there.
Sure.
Just ask you then, after September 11th, did you favor the U.S. toppling the Taliban government?
Oh, absolutely.
Government?
Yes, okay. I did. I mean, there is no question in my mind that it was important after 9/11 for us to make clear what would be the fate of any regime that assisted jihadists who were engaged in launching attacks against the United States. We had to make an example of the Taliban, which we did in overthrowing the Taliban. I mean, but it does not follow that having overthrown the Taliban, you have to then stay there for another decade or so trying to create something in Afghanistan which has never existed, and that is a cohesive, functioning government in Kabul that is able to exercise authority over the entire territorial expanse of Afghanistan. My sense is that, like it or not, the Afghan political tradition is one of decentralized rule in which effective authority is exercised by people that we could call tribal chieftains or warlords, whatever you want to call them, and that actually the best way for us to achieve our limited interest in Afghanistan is probably to work collaboratively, to provide incentives to these warlords to govern their little patch of dirt in ways that are consistent with U.S. interests. Now, what are U.S. interests? U.S. interests are, I think, limited to the fact that as long as al-Qaeda is not given an opportunity to create bases in Afghanistan from which to launch attacks, beyond that, I don't think we care about Afghanistan any more than we care about Uruguay. And it is not necessary for us to undertake the sustained military, economic, nation-building enterprise that President Obama has endorsed in order to achieve those limited interests.
So when you hear about a resurgent Taliban or the return of the Taliban to Afghanistan or even its associations with al-Qaeda along that region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, that doesn't worry you?
Well, you know, it goes back to this notion, gosh, why did 9/11, again, this is another thing that we never really got adequate answers to. Why did 9/11 happen? And the I think the two-pat answer is that 9/11 happened because the U.S., quote-unquote, ignored Afghanistan after the after the Soviet withdrawal. My view would be, no, 9/11 happened in an immediate sense, because federal, state, and local authorities failed in their fundamental requirements to maintain adequate security.
In this country.
In places like the nation's airports. So if you want to prevent another 9/11, the first thing you do, you don't go try to nation build Afghanistan. You erect and maintain robust defenses so that 19 fanatics with box cutters are not able to do things like hijack airplanes. So the whole notion that 9/11 happened because of our failure to fix Afghanistan, in a sense, lets off the hook the government agencies that failed in their most fundamental mission.
So when you hear people, and I'm going to, loosely quote here, talk about winning the war on terror, or winning in victory in Afghanistan, or victory in Iraq, what is your reaction to that?
I'm by no means the first person to say this. I think that there's a very sort of strong school of criticism about the global war on terror that says that a global war on terror is a misguided enterprise from the outset. Terror is a tactic. Now, the problem is one of jihadists, of a relatively small group of people who subscribe to a violent and, I think, perverted notion of Islam, and they are the threat. Those people. It's not terror. It's these groups. My own view would be that rather than saying we're engaged in a war, which of course has led us to invade and occupy countries, that we should view these jihadists as, in essence, an international criminal conspiracy.
Like organized crime in a way?
Like organized crime, and yet the organized crime that draws on this perverted religiosity to sort of give them an even sort of more fanatical approach. And how do you deal with international organized crime? Well, you mount an international posse. Now, I use that very loosely. What I mean is a multilateral, sustained, well-resourced effort to identify and to root out those networks. And that, it seems to me, would be a more effective and less costly approach to trying to ensure our security. I mean, one of the things that just seems to get lost in the conversation is how much the so-called global war on terror has cost us. I mean, it's very difficult to get your hands on accurate figures about what Iraq has cost. Joseph Stiglitz, who won
Harvard University, yep.
Well, a Nobel Prize in economics, not too shabby, has estimated that the war has already cost $1 trillion, and that when all the sort of the books are sort of toted up, it's going to be a $2 or $3 trillion war. Now, that's real money, and it's money we don't have. I mean, you have to connect the dots between the costs that we are incurring, and I'm setting aside here human costs, which are far more important, but the costs we are incurring in sustaining these efforts in places like Iraq and Afghanistan versus the fundamental condition of the country and our needs. I mean, the deficit this year is $1.8 trillion. Estimates during if President Obama wins two terms, probably going to increase the federal deficit by $10 trillion. That's money that we don't have. It's a debt that we are simply laying on the backs of our children and our grandchildren. And it seems to me that back to your question of moral obligation, one of the moral obligations we have is not to dump all over the next generation because of our own fecklessness and our own inability to manage our own affairs.
Well, and this gets to some of the ideas in your book, which is that we have a belief, we meaning the United States has a belief, that we can remake the world. And I guess part of what reinforces that belief is that we spend so much money on our military, and we have bases around the world. We have, I guess, the most high-tech military in the world, with the ability to go anywhere. How do you dial that back? Because, as you said, it's kind of based, as you say in this book, it's based on this notion of American exceptionalism, that we are, in a sense, the exception to the rule.
One of the things that that strikes me more and more is that the most important truths are those that are so obvious that we take them for granted and cannot even see them. And I think you're putting your finger on one of those, and that is the general sort of expectations that the United States has for how to organize its military forces. I'm working on a new book, and in a new book I call it The Sacred Trinity. And the Sacred Trinity, I argue, is the assumption that the United States needs to maintain a global military presence, the conviction that the United States needs to organize its military, not to defend the United States, but for global power projection. And the fact that this presence and this power projection capability then lead to the third element of the Sacred Trinity, which is this penchant for global interventionism. I mean, we've come to sort of, and nobody else does this. Matter of fact, we would view any other country, if the Chinese defense minister got on the radio today and said that China henceforth was going to have a global military presence, we'd go crazy. So nobody else does this. We do. And there's precious little inclination, I think, to actually examine whether the Sacred Trinity serves the country and whether it's affordable and whether or not there may be some alternative way of organizing for our defense.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Andrew Bacevich is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at Boston University, a retired Army colonel, and his most recent book, although clearly he's working on another one, but the most recent one is now out in paperback called The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. We've been talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, and U.S. foreign policy. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you, though, see this exceptionalism and even this desire to project power in the world as arrogance, as idealism, or sort of a strange combustible mixture of the two?
Combustible mixture is probably a good way to describe it. I mean, it's important, I think, to understand the extent to which this idea of our uniqueness, our specialness, really has come to be hardwired, I think, into our national identity. I mean, in the book... I think the founding statement is John Winthrop on the deck of the Arabella, 1630. You know, explaining to his followers the purpose of going to create this new community, which will become Massachusetts Bay Colony, and saying that we, as he said, we are in special covenant with God, and we are here to perform a mission directed by God. And that mission is to create a city upon a hill. Now, people since Winthrop's days don't necessarily make the case with that same sort of direct, vivid religiosity. But the notion that we are unique, the notion that we have a special purpose to be served, the conviction that therefore we should be allowed prerogatives, not permitted to anybody else. This has been a thread throughout American history. And frankly, when you go back and look at the President George W. Bush's response to 9/11, and to look at his immensely eloquent and, I think, utterly wrongheaded second inaugural address, what you see is the perpetuation of this notion of American uniqueness and American exceptionalism. Now, I argue in the book that I believe that actually served us well, that gave to the American project a sense of confidence that in our rise to power actually was very useful. You know, 1846, when the phrase that is used to describe American exceptionalism as manifest destiny. And we claim it is our manifest destiny that California should be part of the Union and should not belong to Mexico. Well, I'm glad California is part of the Union. I think it served us very well. So I think there was a time when American exceptionalism promoted American interests, I believe strongly that it no longer does.
Well, in fact, you say, and I found this most interesting to think about, is that in many ways, U.S. consumption, our living with so much abundance, our desire for things, also has helped to drive this American exceptionalism, because we need energy to drive our economy, to keep us all, you know, filled with stuff.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, we are a materialistic people, and I don't think there's something inherently sinful that people want to live a better life. But it does seem to me that whereas there was a time when the urge for more was promoting, was making us a more powerful country, was generating substantive, real material abundance, and also was creating conditions conducive to more Americans enjoying more freedom, that's no longer the case.
Right.
I think that today, and examples here are the dependence on oil, the dependence on foreign credit, the endless appetite for cheap consumer goods. Today, this urge for more, I think, is reducing American power. It is undercutting our prosperity and is in many respects compromising our freedom. So again, things that once perhaps could be justified no longer ought to be justified, but they have become part of the national wallpaper. Again, the notion that we have U.S. forces in Japan 60 plus years after World War II, U.S. forces in Germany, U.S. forces in Korea, U.S. forces scattered around the Persian Gulf. This is part of the national wallpaper. It's taken for granted. And what we really need to do is to stop and look at the wallpaper and consider maybe the wallpaper is a bit dated, and maybe we should be replaced with something that is more actually suited to our circumstances.
But do you think that the U.S. is capable of learning that lesson, knowing all the history there? But I ask that because, of course, we're in the middle of an economic and financial crisis. People are beginning to cut back on their spending. They're actually saving more. You and I were talking about this before the show began, whether this is a temporary action on the part of the American people or whether we'll go back to our profligate ways.
Well, it really remains to be seen. And I'm afraid that because I'm about to be 62, I tend to be pessimistic at this stage of my life, but I think the reason for my pessimism comes down to this. Remember 9/11. Remember the response to 9/11, which was that this is the day where everything changed. And guess what? It didn't. I mean, it is striking how quickly 9/11 became part of the national wallpaper, how quickly we went back to our profligate ways. I mean, 9/11, apart from the fact that we send these American soldiers off to fight endless wars that we mostly ignore, 9/11 has had virtually no effect on the way we run our affairs. It did not promote self-reflection. It did not cause us to examine seriously the policies that brought us to that day.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Andrew Bacevich, our guest. We are talking about foreign policy, and he's got a book out in paperback now called The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Opera New Jersey supports WHYY and invites members to take an operatic world tour at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, July 10th to 26th. The trip includes stops in the Far East with Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The Mikado, the lowlands of Scotland with Donizetti's bel canto tragedy, Lucia di Lammermoor, and the great Ottoman Empire with Mozart's comedy, The Abduction from the Seraglio. For tickets, 609-258-2787 or for information, opera-nj.org.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY at 10:40. In the second hour at 11, meet members of the local Roots music band, Hoots and Hellmouth. WHYY weather, increasingly cloudy skies, the chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, right through this evening. Today's high around 86 degrees, dropping to 65 overnight. Tomorrow, more rain likely, high in the lower 80s. Thursday, cloudy, still the chance of showers, a little cooler, high around 78.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Workers fight a factory closure in Massachusetts. Their jobs making military apparel are heading to Puerto Rico. Also, a military coup rocks Honduras. What does that mean for Central America? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Andrew Basevich and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get a couple of callers, including Juan from New York City, to join our conversation. Hi, Juan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I'm listening to your caller. I find, you know, his whole premise very interesting, but earlier in the conversation, he had talked about nation building. And he had mentioned that Uruguay somehow was somehow involved in terrorism, and that we shouldn't be nation building Uruguay. I have lots of Uruguayan friends, and none of them have done anything, as far as I can tell, that's bad. I just am kind of confused as to why he's picking on Uruguay.
I haven't
heard anything about Uruguay, and my friends, they might not be the most, you know,
intelligent
people, but they're good people, and I just don't understand why this is happening.
Hold on one little second, and let me give our guests a chance to clarify.
I want to apologize. It was a joke. Obviously, it was a bad joke. I was trying to suggest that U.S. interests in Afghanistan are no greater than U.S. interests in Uruguay. I don't think U.S. interests in either place are very great. I'm not trying to suggest that Uruguay is a hotbed of terrorism. I believe it's not.
Juan, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you had mentioned the fact that we do have bases around the world. Are you suggesting that we essentially fold up our bases and come back home? You've also said it's time for the United States to get out of NATO, for instance.
Right. I do think, as a matter of principle, I think that we should lower our profile. I think that one way you do that is to at least critically evaluate where we have bases. And it doesn't follow that they all come home. But let's take two examples.
Go ahead.
We have this presence in Europe that is part of NATO. We have another presence that goes back to the end of World War II into Korea in East Asia. I would argue that the East Asian presence should be maintained. I think that we have we make a contribution to stability in the region, or to put it another way, if we suddenly pulled the plug in Japan and Korea, that could probably lead to an arms race between Japan, China, and Korea. So let's maintain the status quo. On the other hand, if you look at Europe, which is secure, prosperous, democratic, capable of managing its own national security affairs, why are we there? It seems to me that it would make a lot of sense for us to not pull out of NATO, by next week, but to tell the Europeans that the time has come for Europe to manage its own security and to set a time, that 10 years from now, the last American soldier will leave Western Europe and the last American base will close down. And therefore give them time to adjust to the fact that we're not going to be there to guarantee their security in perpetuity.
Why don't we do that from your perspective?
Well, one can never, I think, underestimate the importance of inertia. This is the way we've always done it. You can never underestimate the importance of institutional interests, that the military services, the military-industrial complex, there are lots of people and institutions invested in the status quo. But again, I think it's really the shallowness of the strategic debate, if you want to call it that, in our country, that these matters simply don't come up for review. It's simply taken for granted that we're somehow called upon to keep U.S. forces in Germany and the U.K. and places like Italy when they're not necessary.
Do you think that's connected to the discussion to try to reduce the defense budget and cut back on weapons and things like that, because there are weapons companies in just about every state in this country, so that a representative, a senator, a member of the U.S. House then pays a kind of political price if there's a loss of a factory within their own.
I mean, there is no reduction in defense spending. I mean, the Obama administration is increasing defense spending. I mean, the debate there, such as there is what pot should the money go into? And what Secretary of Defense Gates has said is that given the fact that we are involved in these protracted low-intensity wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, he wants money to go in the pots that relate to those things, and he's taken money out of the pots that relate to high-tech weapons, like most famously like the F-22. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting debate. I mean, frankly, I think if indeed we want to spend $600 or $700 billion a year on defense, if we have to do that, I'd rather spend it on the soldiers who are actually engaged in warfare. But the big question that doesn't seem to get answered is whether or not defense outlays on that scale actually are necessary, or whether there isn't a cheaper, more effective way to meet our vital security interests. That simply doesn't get asked.
In fact, you say America doesn't need a bigger army. It needs a smaller, that is, more modest foreign policy, one that assigns soldiers missions that are consistent with their capabilities.
Right.
Smaller armies, smaller missions.
Right. I mean, we don't need to have the United States Army, United States Marine Corps, United States military generally, engaged in this effort to create in Afghanistan something which has never existed there. Now, there are some people who would say that, shouldn't we, isn't it terrible that Afghan girls are not allowed to go to school, that the rights of Afghan women are not secured? I think it is terrible. I would simply note that there are many other places in the world where little girls don't get to go to school, and where women are abused. In other words, we live in a world in which there is much evil. I dare say there may even be a certain amount of evil or some social problems here in the city of Philadelphia. And should not those issues come first? I mean, why can't we try to fix America before we try to fix Afghanistan? And I say that somewhat, ironically, because we're never going to be able to fully fix America, but nonetheless, that ought to be the priority.
Let me get Michelle from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest, what do you think or envision a lower profile America would look like, and how do you envision the rest of the world would react if America decided to become lower profile?
Michelle, thanks for the call. Andrew Bacevich?
Well, there are lots of ways to get at that question. I mean, we just did a minute ago, and we talked about, which military commitments you ought to sustain and what you could draw down. But I think, without trying to sound grandiose, it sounds like you're dodging the question. I don't mean to do that. But I think that the fundamental question comes down to being, should We have a set of convictions that we profess to be faithful to, and the convictions revolve around the word freedom that we believe, that we manifest, that we represent. Now, our definition of freedom is constantly changing, but nonetheless, that's what we are about. And I think the fundamental question comes down to, do we advance the cause of freedom most effectively by manifesting freedom? By demonstrating to the world what a society committed to liberal values looks like? Or do we advance the cause of freedom by using American power, and almost necessarily hard power, to try to force the rest of the world to look the way we look?
And hard power is force.
And hard power is military power.
It's military power.
That's right. Now, President George W. Bush was absolutely certain after 9/11 that it was through the use of hard power that we could make the world free, starting in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think we've seen the results. People may differ. I think the results are rather discouraging. And so I would like to have greater attention be given to this notion. I recognize it's heretical, to this notion that we can best advance the cause of freedom by showing what freedom really should mean here at home.
Well, let me take the example of Iran and questions about the election. We're seeing obviously less today, but certainly a couple of weeks ago, huge protests on the streets of Tehran, other cities in Iran, questions raised about whether this election was fair or not. President Obama's been very careful, I would say, about the kind of rhetoric that he has used and the way he has described what's gone on there. But using that as an example, what do you think the U.S. should do?
Well, I think I know President Obama has been criticized by some on the right for not being sort of animated enough in denouncing the mullahs. I actually think he's handled it very, very, very well. I think Iran is a very good example of what I think ought to be a core principle of U.S. policy, and that is to recognize that at the end of the day, other peoples will determine their fate. You know, I imagine the great majority of us sympathize with young people who are in the streets, not just young people, all kinds of people who are in the streets and denouncing the regime in Iran. It doesn't follow that had that revolution succeeded, that we would have ended up with a pro-American, pro-Western liberal democracy in Tehran that was going to get rid of its nuclear weapons program and make peace with Israel.
In fact, we're learning that might not have happened.
I think it's actually would not have happened, which doesn't affect one's judgment of, you know, where your sympathies lie. You lie with the people who are demanding the right to define freedom for themselves and to claim it. So I'm heartened by the fact that the events in Iran testify to, first of all, the abject failure of the Islamic Revolution of 1979 to deliver on anything it promised. I'm heartened by this evidence that there is political energy in opposition, that there is political life in Iran. And as far as I'm concerned, we ought to wish them well and not muck around on some sort of assumption that we can save the Iranian people or we can direct the Iranian pro-democracy movement, if that's what it is. Let us simply show them what a democratic and freedom-loving people look like in the way they live.
Let me get to Gerald from Philadelphia. Michelle, thanks for the call. Gerald, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I'm totally on board with a lot of things that you're saying, and I agree that becoming meddling in people other affairs of other countries ultimately down the line is not going to guarantee that we have friends or that it's going to come back in a positive way. And look what's happened in Iraq. But and you know, also I got to tell you, even with your last caller, I think that the Uruguay thing, I think that we should, you know, hey,
Gerald, we should put them on a terrorist. Do me a favor and just ask your question. The Uruguay thing kind of got us off track here.
How many terrorists are in Uruguay? Well, I don't want to go in. I want to boost up the airport security, like you guess said.
Okay, well, let me ask the question that I see on the computer here, just because I'm looking at the clock and I want to just be able to put this straight to our guest Andrew Bacevich, which is, how then do we get out of Afghanistan and Iraq?
Right, exactly.
How do we get out of Afghanistan? Okay, fair enough, Gerald.
Now that we're in,
how do we get out?
In a situation. That's what I'm saying with the Uruguay. Like, we don't want to end up there and then not be able to get out.
I hear you. Go ahead.
I don't want to go into Uruguay, but I do want to put them on a terrorist watch list, and I want to get out of Afghanistan. But now we're in. We can't go around. We can't now just, you know, we have to win the hearts and minds.
Fair enough. And I appreciate the call. And let me get that back to our guest here.
I want to go on record as opposing putting Uruguay in the terrorist watch list.
Thank you very much.
On Afghanistan, I think that, I mean, it's a very good question. You know, you're in, you can't just sort of wave your hands and pretend you're not in. But I think that the answer is that we need to probably establish a schedule, you know, not a schedule like 6 months from now, schedule 2 years from now, that we will withdraw. Between now and then, do our best to build up an effective Afghan security force, do our best to try to establish relationships with the warlords to see if we can provide them incentives so that as we leave, they won't simply sort of open their arms to allow al-Qaeda to come. And quite frankly, we keep a hammer in our back pocket. And the hammer in our back pocket is, I mean, I've been critical of hard power. I'm not a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in having effective forces and using them sparingly when it's needed. Should it be the case that Al-Qaeda is able to establish training camps in Afghanistan after we leave, then we need to destroy them. And if we can do that, we can keep them at a very minimum off balance and therefore complicate any efforts they have to conspire to put together new attacks.
Do you believe in the kind of hearts and mind approach to foreign policy?
No. I mean, I think it's extraordinarily difficult for us to set aside our Western biases, conceptions, values, and see life through the eyes of people who culturally, historically, religiously simply come from another place.
Are you a pessimist?
I'm afraid I am, yes.
I mean, is that, as you said, you're approaching 62. Is it based on that, or no, is it based on – and you served in Vietnam, I should say.
Well, I think – I mean, I believe I am a realist. I think what it comes down to, in a sense, is that there are people who – and people tend to be, in, a lot of them in Washington, who think that history is a good news story, that, you know, we're headed towards some final destination where – the world will be at peace and everybody will enjoy freedom and all of God's children will live together. My sense of history is that it's not a good news story. It's a bad news story, that it is a tragedy, and that therefore the best we can hope to do is to try to cope with extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And if you can get through the day without having committed some, you know, disaster, then that's probably the definition of a good day. So I don't think I was jokingly said I'm a pessimist. I think I'm actually a realist.
Well, much more to talk about. I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a professor of international relations and history at Boston University, a retired Army colonel, served in the Vietnam War. And his most recent book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, is now out in paperback. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.